Hello, I'm John Horning, and this is Shaking Scripture's Leaves, a podcast where we think through Scripture one passage, one topic at a time, until we have shaken all of its leaves. And this week, we are continuing through a series on Ecclesiastes that I started a couple weeks ago. Last week, I didn't end up posting an episode because I was teaching in my church's college group, and so the time that I would have given towards the preparation and recording of a podcast episode instead went towards the preparation and delivery of that message. But we are back again this week. And this week, we're going to be starting through Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 12, and we're going to be going through Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 11. And last week, we went through Solomon's initial thesis regarding life under the sun. The fact that life under the sun is a vapor. It's brief, and because it's brief, it's also empty. It's insubstantial. And we went through his initial explanation of his thesis, the fact that your life is going to be short, and also no pleasure you have is ever going to satisfy you, and that means that the brevity of your life will always cut your pleasure short, that your pleasure has no ultimate value to it, and that means that your life of pleasure will have no ultimate value to it, at least within the boundaries of this own life. But this week, after Solomon has made that claim, he starts going through the specific areas in life in which you can see that principle working itself out. And this week, Solomon starts with his own experience. From verse 12 through the end of chapter 2, he first talks about the way that that brevity and pleasure works its way out in his own life, where he's not ultimately satisfied with good. And then after chapter 2, verse 11, through the end of chapter 2, he starts discussing his own pursuit of a legacy. So those two pieces of his initial thesis in chapter 1, the fact that you're never going to be satisfied with pleasure, and that means that this life will always end before you've been satisfied, he's going to discuss that within his own experience this week. And next week, when we look at the second half of chapter 2, we're going to be seeing him defend his claim that you're also not going to have a legacy. But we're going to be going through the beginning of chapter 2, and we're going to be going through Solomon's own experience. And then after chapter 2, he starts looking beyond his own experience, but we haven't got there yet. So with that, if we start reading into the chapter, in chapter 1, verse 12, it says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I have given my heart to seeking and to investigating with wisdom all which is done under the heavens. It is an evil task which God has given to the sons of Adam to do. And in this, like we said, Solomon has already given you his conclusion in the first chapter, but he's transitioning into his own experience, his own observations, his own study of the world, and his own study of the world, which he did with his wisdom. And as we established last week, God gave Solomon extraordinary wisdom. So if anyone's got the ability to really observe life and study life and consider its implications and principles, it's going to be Solomon. But also, this is something that I personally enjoy quite a bit about the Bible and also about Ecclesiastes in particular. You see, Solomon, in all of his wisdom, he's been able to observe and study the world, and he could have just given you a list of his conclusions. Like, if you've ever read the book of Proverbs, which for the most part was also written by Solomon, there are sections of the book of Proverbs which are just compilations of lessons. You know, Proverb chapter 1, Proverb 1, and then another proverb, and then another proverb, and just a dry list of the observations that Solomon has made about life. And Ecclesiastes could have been that, but it wasn't. There are also sections of Proverbs where Solomon tells a story about how he saw a young man walking down the street, and this young man was a fool because this young man went up to the house of a harlot and then was persuaded into her house, and then he's carried off and dragged away like an oxen which is led to the slaughter, and he does not know that the dead are in her home. And like, he tells you this story, and that's how he packages the lesson that he's trying to give you. And in a similar way, Ecclesiastes, it actually follows along with the stories of Solomon's life. It starts with the story of his own life, and then he goes through and he keeps referencing the observations of the world that he sees around him, and a lot of his points are actually encapsulated in sometimes quick stories and sometimes long stories and other times in poetic sequences. And so all of that is just to say that Ecclesiastes is written to be engaging. And a lot of times, even when we read Ecclesiastes, we find that Ecclesiastes is fairly engaging, even if it's not engaging in the way that we might prefer. There's a lot of people that read Ecclesiastes, and it's just so disheartening for them and so depressing, but also they can't quite look away. It's like watching a train wreck, because Solomon did a good job of writing something that actually grabs your attention. And so, especially in Hebrew, this is more apparent that it's just well-written and well-crafted, even down to the word level. But when you translate the Bible into English, a lot of times that translation ends up with having a clunkier, just clunkier sentence structure, clunkier paragraphs, clunkier words. And it's kind of difficult to avoid that while still conveying the exact meaning of the text. But even in English, there's a fair bit of that just well-crafted writing that still makes its way through. And part of that includes the fact that Solomon is telling you a story. He's not just giving you the lessons he's learned, but he is packaging those lessons to you in a narrative context. Solomon's not just saying, hey, here are the lessons I've learned. He's saying, hey, let me walk you through how I learned those lessons. Let me tell you a story. And I think that's something that we shouldn't have lost on us. Like, God did a good job when he wrote the Bible. Like, the Bible is not just really helpful content, but it's well-worded, well-crafted content. And that's something that the more I study it, the older I get, the more I appreciate that about the Bible. The fact that it's good writing. And so Solomon is transitioning to his own experience, but it's worth noting that he's bringing you through his own story. And he's trying to deliver this to you very similarly to how he would deliver it to you in a conversation. Like, the writing of Ecclesiastes is extremely conversational, where if you were to sit across from Solomon at the end of his life, this might be the conversation he has with you. Like, if you were to interview him about the way that he lived his life, the lessons he learned from life, and what advice he would have to give you, you would end up with a conversation very similar to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's basically a one-sided conversation, and it's written to be engaging. It's written to young people. So Solomon turns to his own experience, and in verse 14, he says, I have seen all the works which are done under the sun, and know this, all is vapor and striving after wind, which we've already talked about the meaning of the fact that everything is vapor, that brevity and that lack of substance. But then when you see striving after wind, that's like trying to chase a breeze. That's like trying to capture the wind in a jar. And the fact that that's just impossible. You can never catch up to the wind. You can never grab the wind. It's something that you can't hold on to. It's something that you can't really pursue. And if you were to try to pursue the wind, you would never get to it. So in the same way that life is a vapor, life is also striving after wind. It's a futile endeavor. And why? Because verse 15, what has been made crooked cannot be straightened, and what is missing cannot be counted. The things that God has bent, you can't set straight. And the things that don't exist, you can't count them. Essentially, Solomon is looking at your life and he's saying, there are things in life that you actually can't accomplish, that you don't have the strength to accomplish, that we might want to look at the world system that exists around us, and we might want to make some extraordinary, long-reaching, far-reaching change to it. We might want to be able to change the world on our own. We might want to be able to be the superhero that makes the changes that no one else in the world can. You know, there are billions of people on the earth, and there are billions of people who have lived, but we want to be that one that rises above everyone else by our own bootstraps and makes a permanent change. And it's like, you don't have it in you. Even oftentimes, the people that we think rise up on their own, they did it with an army of people behind them. And even when you do something, quote, on your own, you're really standing on the shoulders of the others who helped you get there. And even with all that help, sun still rises, sun still sets. Whatever change you make, as we talked about in the last time, it's ultimately not going to be on the scale of reality. It's not going to be on the scale of the earth. It's not going to be on the scale of all society and all time. And so Solomon is reminding you, part of what makes your attempts to change the world futile is that you actually just don't have the capability to change the world. And that's related to the point that he made last week. And so he looks at the inability to change the world in an ultimate sense. And in verse 16, he shifts gears. He's like, okay, well, I spoke to my heart saying, look, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, and my heart knew the increase of wisdom and knowledge. Which, this is one of those things that, again, we addressed last time, just saying that after Solomon, there is no one else who can make this claim. So verse 16, even if it's a weird way for him to refer to himself, what is absolutely certain is that there's no one after Solomon who can make this claim. So again, this is another place where the author of Ecclesiastes is claiming to be Solomon, which I'm not going to keep beating that dead horse anymore, but just to like really put that out there, it's something that a lot of people want to contest, but there's no real basis for it if you hold to inspiration. If you believe that the Bible is written by God, then Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. There's really no consistent way to not think Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes and also think that God inspired this. So putting that out there, how do you know Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes? No one else can say what he says in verse 16. But back to the actual point, he says, I spoke to my heart saying, look, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, and my heart knew the increase of wisdom and knowledge. And then I gave my heart to the knowledge of wisdom and the knowledge of madness and foolishness, and I saw that even this is striving after wind. Indeed, with much wisdom is much vexation, and increasing knowledge increases pain. And this is an interesting thing, and this is also a principle, by the way, that you can kind of understand the more you learn things. The way that once you've learned a lesson and you see other people acting foolishly, acting not having learned that lesson, you kind of feel pain for them. Like, this is a really, really dumb example, but we've all been in a situation where we were a kid and we had a pot on the stove and then we touched the pot despite the fact it was hot, and like the first time you just burn your hand on a hot pot. I did that multiple times because apparently I was a slow learner, but I'm sure that all of us have had that experience. And could you imagine, which I've actually had the opportunity to see this sort of thing happen. I have an uncle, and this uncle had a young kid, and this young kid wanted to touch a hot pot. And so my uncle said, yeah, don't touch that pot. It's hot. It's going to hurt you. And the young kid wanted to touch the pot anyway. So the next time that the kid went to touch the pot, instead of warning him, my uncle just let his kid touch the pot, and the kid hurt his hand. And my uncle was just like, here's the thing. My kid has just learned that when dad tells you not to do something, there's a reason dad tells you not to do something. But I'm sure that a lot of you guys are hearing that story, and you can imagine being there watching this person about to touch the hot pot, and you, having touched that hot pot yourself, whew, you're feeling the pain on their behalf before they even get the sizzle, right? And if you've ever heard the saying, those who are ignorant of history are doomed to repeat it, and those who are not ignorant of history are doomed to watch others repeat it. Where the more you know, the more painful other people's foolishness is to you, and Solomon would have had that even more than anyone else who ever lived. So there's that aspect. But then there's also the other aspect of the more wisdom you have. And for Solomon, the more he's pondering the ultimately best way to live life, the more he is seeing that life doesn't live up to what he wants it to be. That life in and of itself, that life under the sun does not contain within it something worth pursuing to make life an ultimate good. And so the more Solomon is trying to unwind this puzzle of what is the best way to live life, what is the way to live life that will grant me ultimate satisfaction, and the more he keeps coming up empty, the more vexation and the more pain he feels as he keeps beating his head against this wall. And so he concludes that indeed with much wisdom is much vexation, and increasing knowledge increases pain. So Solomon doesn't find the answer, but he continues considering his own experience, and he gives you more of the story. He's like, well, let me tell you what I mean by that. Let me bring you through the journey that I went through. In verse 1 of chapter 2, it says, I said to my heart, please go. Let me test you with pleasure. Experience good. But even this is a vapor. Of laughter, I said, ridiculous. And of rejoicing, what does it accomplish? I investigated with my heart how to seize my body with wine while my heart was guiding me with wisdom in order to take hold of folly until I would see where man can find good to do under the heavens in the numbered days of their lives. And so Solomon turns to enjoyment. He turns to pleasure. And yet he turns to pleasure while still guided by his wisdom. And here's the thing about pursuing pleasure in the short term. You can pursue short-term pleasure in such a way that it messes you up long-term. For example, doing heroin. You might do heroin and have a real blast in the moment, but you've just really hampered your ability to get the most out of life in the mid to long term, right? Drug addiction, alcoholism, and quite frankly, many more things fall under that category. But Solomon, in his extraordinary wisdom, is in every single moment able to glean and just squeeze out every last drop of pleasure right up until the point that it would hamper his ability to do it again tomorrow. Where because of Solomon's extraordinary wisdom, he's able to get pleasure from life at the maximum. He knows exactly where that line is, where he's, you know, taking too much pleasure right now, where he won't be able to get more pleasure in the future. And so he's able to constantly maximize the amount of pleasure he's able to have both right now and in the future. And that's because of his wisdom, where he's essentially able to tiptoe right up to the line of foolishness and self-destruction and keep himself from going off. And so Solomon is able to enjoy pleasure in a way that, quite frankly, no one else would be able to. Solomon is able to get every last drop of pleasure out of this life in a way that no one else would be able to imitate. So he gets pleasure, and that's verse 3. And then in verse 4, he says, I magnified my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made myself gardens and paradises, and I planted in them trees of every fruit. And so Solomon's not just enjoying like straight hedonistic pleasure, but he's also making himself toys. He's amassing wealth. He's accomplishing things. He has things that he's able to do and then look at them and be proud of himself. Like when you win a spelling bee, or when you win a tournament, or when you make some report that gets praised as being the best essay written in the class, or when you get that promotion at work, or when you get the Employee of the Year award, when you accomplish something cool, Solomon is doing that, but he's doing that with royal scale. I want to comment a bit on this in verse 5, when he says, I made myself gardens and paradises, and I planted in them trees of every fruit. I want to draw your attention to that word, paradises. Some of your guys' translations might have something like gardens and parks. Now, a paradise, that is an enclosed royal garden. So if you've ever heard, for example, of like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, ancient kingdoms, the royalty in those kingdoms would often make a really, really fancy garden within their palace or just within their capital city. And it would be a display of extravagant wealth, and it would also just be a display of extravagant beauty. It would be an incredible sight to see. Like, I believe that the Hanging Gardens of Babylon is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And so Solomon's making something pretty cool, but when we talk about the word paradise, I'm going to tell you what that word is in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the word for paradise is pardes. Now, one of the first things that my first Hebrew professor taught me and my class is that if you speak Hebrew to your audience in a presentation, it's because you're a tool. But there is a reason that I'm telling you that the Hebrew word for paradise is pardes. When I say the word pardes, and I'm talking about really cool gardens, is there a word in English that, you know, comes to your mind? You might already know, because it's the word I used to translate this word, and it's the word paradise. That's because that's literally the word paradise. Like, our word paradise is the same word, basically, that's in Hebrew. Like, when we refer to ancient languages, this word shows up in a lot of ancient languages. It shows up in which I'm about to try to pronounce a lot of these, and I'm going to butcher all of their pronunciations, so prepare yourself. But in ancient Persian, the word is paradesia is the word paradesa. In Greek, it's paradesos. In Mishnaic Hebrew, it's pardes. In Jewish Aramaic, it's pardesa. In late Babylonian, it's pardesu. In Syrian, it's pardesa. And so the reason I'm telling you all that is, like, you might not know what all those languages are. You might not have been able to piece together my lousy pronunciations. But I want you to notice that this word is all over the place in the ancient world. And in fact, people will often use this word to try to argue that Solomon didn't write Ecclesiastes. They'll say that this word is a Persian word. And that Persian word is the first one that I gave you, where I just butchered the pronunciation. But they'll say that this is a Persian loan word. And so Persia didn't have global control until around the year 500 BC. And so they say, well, hey, this couldn't have been written before 500 BC because it's used in a Persian loan word. But the reality is this. Like, I just gave you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different ancient languages in the ancient Near East that all had this word in them. We actually have no idea what language this word originates in. And in fact, if Solomon is the author of Ecclesiastes, then that would make Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon, both of which use this word, the oldest uses of this word that we actually have a record of, putting them around 900 BC. So, you'll hear that argument sometimes that the reason that Solomon couldn't be the author of Ecclesiastes, among other things, is because he uses this Persian loan word. And reality is, we have no idea where this word started. In fact, I'm going to give you a crack theory. You see, in Hebrew, the word for fruit, like fruit tree, is pari. And then the word for green and green vegetation is deshe. So if I were to try to put those words together, because what Solomon puts in his paradise is a bunch of trees of every fruit, then he might have taken the word for fruit, pari, and then combined it with the word for green vegetation, deshe. Where if you slam them together, you get pari deshe, pari deshe, pari deshe, pari des, pari des, pari des, pari des, pari des. And you can kind of like imagine that they might have been jammed together like that. And I'm not saying that that's what happened. I'm just saying that's a possibility. Because maybe Solomon made a really cool enclosed garden, and so he named it a pardes. And then we know from 1 Kings that rulers and dignitaries from other nations from all over the place were coming to seek Solomon and to see his wisdom and to see his riches. And we know that Israel during the reign of Solomon was so prosperous that silver wasn't worth anything. Again, that's in 1 Kings, where if you walked by silver on the ground, you just wouldn't pick it up because it was just a rock. Like, that's how rich Israel was. And so maybe Solomon came up with this really cool idea for paradises, and then a bunch of other rulers came by and saw it, and then they were like, wow, that's pretty baller. And then they went back to their own countries, and they started making their own paradises, and they called them paradises. And again, I'm not saying that that's actually what happened, that like Solomon coined this phrase and that that's where everyone else gets it. But what I am saying is that that's a valid alternative to the idea that this is a Persian loan word from 500 BC. And the reality, again, is that we have no idea where this word comes from. This word might be originally Hebrew. It might be originally Persian. They might both get it from some other language. We have no idea. But then the other thing that I want to point out to you is just how little this word has changed in the time that it's been in use. Like, again, Ecclesiastes is written around 900 BC, and the word is pardes, and the consonants in that word are P, are, well, they're the Hebrew equivalent of P-R-D-S. In modern English, the consonants in our word are P-R-D-S. So we still use this word almost unchanged about 3,000 years later. Like, that's just so cool. That's just super nifty. Like, that's like holding a piece of history in your hand every time you say the word paradise. That's like seeing George Washington's coat, or seeing a piece of jewelry that Cleopatra wore, or holding in your hand, like, I don't know, a piece of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I don't know. That's a piece of history, man. Like, in our language, we have a piece of history that's about 3,000 years old at least. And every time you say the word paradise, you're, in a sense, joining into that ancient history. And that's just cool. Anyways, so that's this word paradise. And the reason that I'm referencing that, specifically with Solomon's argument, is that he's going to go on. He says, I magnified my works, verse 4. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made myself gardens and paradises, and I planted in them trees of every fruit. Verse 5, I made myself gardens and paradises. Well, I'm saying verse 5 twice. That's fine. I made myself gardens and paradises, and I planted in them trees of every fruit. And I made myself pools of water to irrigate a forest of growing trees with them. And so here's the thing that's significant about Solomon's use of the word paradise. In the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which is the Septuagint, the word paradise is used to translate something else, which some of you guys might be aware of this, but paradise is a reference to a specific garden. It's used to reference heaven, but it's also used to reference the Garden of Eden. That in the Septuagint, when in Genesis chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, when it says that the Lord God planted a garden in Eden, that word garden, the Septuagint translates it paradise, or the Greek word for paradise. And so the word that Solomon is using here is the same word that the Septuagint uses to translate Garden of Eden. And like I said, I'm not saying that it's the same word that the Septuagint uses to translate this word. Like I said, this word appears in both languages. I'm saying that this word is the word that the Septuagint uses to translate garden in the phrase Garden of Eden. So in the Greek Old Testament, they would call it the Paradise of Eden, the enclosed paradise Garden of Eden. And the point that I'm making is this. When Solomon is discussing what he made for himself, he basically made himself his own paradise. He made for himself paradise on earth. He's trying to make for himself a little Garden of Eden. And you'll notice that it's not even just the phrase paradise, that word garden that comes before. That is the word that is used in the Genesis chapter 2 to refer to the Garden of Eden, but it's also a pretty common word, so that's not a huge deal. But if you listen to the description of Solomon's gardens in verses 5 to 6, he made for himself gardens and paradises, and he planted in them trees of every fruit. Well, let's look at the description of the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 2, verse 9. And out of the ground the Lord God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. In other words, fruit trees. So Solomon made a paradise and put a bunch of fruit trees in it, just like God made the Garden of Eden and put a bunch of fruit trees in it. And then in verse 6, he made himself pools of water in order to water that forest of growing trees. Well, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 10, it says that a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and there it divided and became four rivers. Just like God planted a garden and put a bunch of really cool fruit trees in it, and then he made a pool or a spring from which to water that garden, Solomon is making himself a paradise that he's planting a bunch of really cool fruit trees in, and that he's making pools of water for himself to water that paradise. He's making himself a little miniature Garden of Eden. And so the point that's being made is this. Solomon, this extraordinarily wealthy king, this extraordinarily wise king, is trying to live life as best as he possibly can, and he tells you that he made himself his own little Garden of Eden, that he's trying to make for himself a little paradise on earth, that he's not just trying to enjoy himself as much as possible from the day to day, but that he is crafting his environment into as close to heaven as he can get it, that he's making himself a paradise. Solomon is living life as best and as pleasurably as life can possibly be lived. There is no one, especially not anyone like us, us normies, that are going to be able to live life in the way that Solomon lived life. And he goes on in verse 7, he says, I bought male and female slaves, and I had slaves born in my house. You know, not much to be said for the character of Solomon, but that was established when you read 1 Kings anyway. We're not looking at Solomon as the moral paragon for most of his life, but Homeslice had slaves, and he had lots of them. Additionally, I increased my buying cattle and flocks more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, so Homeslice was loaded. And I also acquired silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I had male and female singers and the pleasures of the sons of Adam, many concubines. Which, if you've read 1 Kings, you know that Solomon had 700 concubines and 300 wives. So that's true. But I will also kind of mention this about that phrase, many concubines. It's actually very difficult to know what that word is. So it could be concubines, as in like women. But it could also be coffers, like you would fill your coffers with gold and money. It could also be cupbearers or like other things that refer to containers. And so there's a lot of debate about that. I lean towards concubines, partially because we've already talked about all of his gold, silver, and everything, and now we're talking about his male and female singers. And when Solomon is pursuing a lot of pleasure in foolishness, it would be a little bit odd if he didn't mention sexual pleasure anywhere, if he only talked about like having a bunch of riches and having really cool music and slaves, but then he didn't talk about having a bunch of wives or having a bunch of concubines. Like, there would be a noticeable lack there. So I kind of lean towards that one. But also, it is really difficult. And all of the ancient translations of this have some form of, like, coffer or treasury or something. But whether this is referring to Solomon, like, really having lots of women as well as all of his riches, or whether it's just talking about the fact that Solomon had everything he wanted, and he also just had lots and lots of money. In either case, roughly the same point is being made. Solomon has quite the portfolio. Like Solomon's life, you talk to just about any young person and you were like, hey, if you could have anything that you wanted in life, what would you want? You know, you might find a young person and the young person would be like, you know what? I want to have what I want when I want it. Well, you know what? Solomon had what he wanted when he wanted it. You might have someone who says, you know what? I just want to be rich. I want to spend my life making as much money as possible. Well, you know what? Solomon was loaded. Solomon was so incredibly rich that in his entire country, like I said earlier, silver was regarded as worthless. So you might go to a young person and say, well, what do you want? And they might say, you know what? I want to accomplish something. I want to build things. I want to make stuff that makes a difference. I want to make monuments that stand after I'm gone. And well, Solomon did that too. Solomon built the palace. Solomon built the temple. Solomon built houses. He made works. He made beautiful gardens. Solomon didn't just enjoy things. Solomon accomplished things. And like I said earlier, Ecclesiastes is specifically written to young people. And Solomon puts his life forward. And Solomon's life is the paragon of what just about any young person would envy to have. And so Solomon looks at a young person, and again, you can imagine Solomon sitting across from you at a coffee shop, looking at you and knowing exactly what you think you want out of life, and just being like, let me tell you, I had everything you want. I experienced life with the utmost pleasure. I got every drop of good out of this life that it could give. I had it all. I accomplished things. I enjoyed it, every moment of it. And as you're sitting there across from Solomon, just salivating at the idea of whether or not you could be in a position like that, Solomon has more to say. In verse 9, he continues and he kind of like puts a lid on it, summarizes it, and he says, I became great and I increased beyond anyone who was before me in Jerusalem, and even my wisdom was standing beside me. Everything my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not hold back my heart from any of the joy that my heart enjoyed from all of my work, and this was my portion from all of my work. Which, notice this as well, it wasn't just Solomon's leisure that was enjoyable. There are a lot of people that they wake up every morning, they go to a job they hate, and they come back and they rest and they do it again the next morning, and they do all of that so that they can enjoy their evenings and so they can enjoy their weekends. And maybe they're funding their hobbies, but they just can't stand their job. There are a lot of people that live life like that, and Solomon is saying, hey, I didn't just have a blast in my free time. I had a lot of fun in my free time, and I had a lot of toys, but also I loved my work. I didn't just enjoy the free time, I enjoyed my toil. So if you had a young person and you said, hey, if you could have everything you wanted when you wanted it, if you could have all of the toys and all of the riches, if you could have a comfortable life, if you could have all of the money and pleasure that you want, and if you could accomplish things, if you could make things, and bonus points, if you also just loved your job. Like, can you see how this is essentially Solomon painting a picture of the perfect life and saying, I had that? Well, what does Solomon think about all of that? As Solomon is sitting at the end of his life, having experienced all of that, and now looking at us who are deciding how we're going to spend our lives, what does he say about everything that he experienced? In verse 11, he says, I considered all my work which my hands did and the labor which I labored to do, and know this, all is vapor and striving after wind, and there is no profit under the sun. Solomon looks at you and he looks at me as we're salivating over all of the things that we think we want. As we're salivating and fighting for all of the things that we think are going to make this life so good, Solomon says, I did all of that. And believe me when I tell you, it wasn't the answer. It was vapor. It was short-lived. And the reason, like, just for me personally, one of the reasons that Ecclesiastes is so valuable to me, one of the reasons that Ecclesiastes is so encouraging to me and helpful to me is that I'm young. And I mean, I'm getting older every day, as many of us are, but I'm still pretty young. And it's very tempting for me to look at the life that I have ahead of me and to fall into the temptation of being preoccupied with all of the things that Solomon was preoccupied with. It's easy for me to be preoccupied with my career and making sure that I have a job I love. It's easy for me to be preoccupied with figuring out how I'm going to make as much money as I can and maybe set aside enough money to graduate retire early and to have some good stuff in my free time, to have a nice, comfortable bank account. And it's like, for me, when I'm young, it's easy for me to be preoccupied with those things. And to constantly fall into the temptation of thinking, you know what, I've got a lot of my life ahead of me, might as well enjoy it instead of using my life for the pursuit of other things. And then to read Ecclesiastes, and then in the very beginning, the first thing that Solomon does is Solomon takes the thing that I, as a young person, and I'm sure that many of us, not even just as young people, but just as people, Solomon takes that thing that I am so eager to want. And he starts by laying it on thick and saying, I had it all, and reminding me that is not the thing that makes life worth living. And in a sense, shaking me out of my funk and being like, John, forget about that. I'm not just going to tell you what's worth pursuing, because in the back of your mind, you're going to still want this stuff and you're going to have competing affections. So Solomon starts and he says, let me show you the thing you want and remind you where it leads you. Because for me right now, I might feel like I have a lot of my life ahead of me. But it's like my uncle always used to tell me, snap your fingers and you're 80. And for Solomon, Solomon is living at the end of his life, having experienced all of that pleasure, having had all of his toys, and now he's looking at his impending death, looking back on the life that he lived, and he's realizing, oh dear, I'm still not satisfied. I had 60 years of good. I had a lifetime of extraordinary good, but that's not doing anything for me now. I'm not ultimately satisfied by that. You see, Solomon is looking at the last 60 years of his life and all of the fun that he had, and if you offered Solomon another 500, he'd hop on it. He'd be like, heck yeah, I want more of that. He's mourning the fact that he doesn't have any of that pleasure left to enjoy. He would take another 500 years. He would take another 5,000 years. But then that 5,000 years would pass in a blink too. And then eventually he'd be sitting at the end of that 5,000 years, looking back at all the fun he had, unable to still have that fun because none of it satisfies. And at the end of his life, he's going to look back, or he is looking back, and he's recognizing that the opportunity he had to enjoy life, it's over. Was there anything else he could have done instead? And so for me, it shakes me out of my funk and it helps me. And I will say this, there is something that I want to mention at this stage of Ecclesiastes. There's a statement in Ecclesiastes that you're going to find pretty often. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 24, there's this statement that there's nothing good in man that he should eat and drink and make his soul see good with labor. And then it says that this is a gift that God gives him. So pleasure is a genuinely good thing. And one of the things that you're going to find in Ecclesiastes is that labor and pleasure are genuinely referred to as a good thing in life. Like, it's not a sin to enjoy pleasure, and the answer to Ecclesiastes is not to live life as an aesthetic. But it is not an ultimate good. And so, one of the things that I kind of want to just prime your mind with, I typically recommend that you read Ecclesiastes in multiple passes, where the first pass, you read Ecclesiastes and you get the main argument. But after you've gotten the point of Ecclesiastes and you're no longer living for life under the sun, but you're instead living for what lies beyond it, you can read Ecclesiastes again, because Ecclesiastes, Solomon goes through a series of these situations where he sets up life as best as it can possibly be, just like he did just now. Solomon had all the money, all the paradise, all the riches, all the good, all of the goodies that you want, and it still wasn't good enough. And Solomon just sets up multiple maximums where he's like, let's make the life as best as possible in this way. Still not good enough. Let's make life as good as possible in this way. You know what? Still not good enough. But if I'm not living life to try to have my ultimate satisfaction in this life, and I'm ultimately living life for what lies beyond it, then if I read through Ecclesiastes again, and I see Solomon talking about all of the things that make life as amazing as possible, well, it's not wrong to enjoy life. As long as it's not my ultimate goal, if that's not what I ultimately want out of life, there's nothing wrong with seeing an enjoyable path and a not enjoyable path, and then if both of them are equally pleasing to God, take the enjoyable path. And experience the pleasure that God gives you. Like, Ecclesiastes routinely talks about the fact that the one who lets you enjoy pleasure is God himself, and that it's a gift of God that he gives you out of love and kindness. And so that is also a point. And so while we are making the point that pleasure itself is not worth giving your life to, like, you should not sacrifice your life on the altar of pleasure. It's a bad idea. It's not worth it. And you will sit at the end of your life regretting that decision, just like Solomon did. But also enjoy the good that exists in life. It's a gift of God. But we do need to start from this conclusion. where Solomon is expecting, as you continue to move through Ecclesiastes, that you read chapter 1 and 2. He's expecting that you paid attention. When he said, I had pleasure, as much pleasure as this life had to offer, and it wasn't good enough. Because multiple times in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is going to return to pleasure. He's going to like consider some area of life, and he's going to say, you know what, that's still not good enough, and I perceived that there is nothing better for a man that he should eat and drink and make his soul see good and experience good in his labor. Like, Solomon routinely comes back to that there's nothing better than pleasure. And the fact that there's nothing better than pleasure doesn't mean that pleasure is the ultimate good life offers. Solomon starts there because every single time as he continues to move through the book of Ecclesiastes that he comes back and says there's nothing better than pleasure, you're supposed to have already paid attention to the beginning of Ecclesiastes. You're supposed to already know that that means that we are back where we started, that we're back to the beginning of not having any ultimately good way to live life. And then Solomon's going to branch off into another set of considerations. And so it kind of makes this really weird, like, spiraling structure to the book where it's like, let's look at this, and then it doesn't work out. And so we come back to pleasure, and it's like, well, we know pleasure's not the answer, so let's look at long life. And it's like, well, long life's not it, so maybe it's pleasure. But it's like, well, actually, no, because we already know pleasure's not the answer, and then you branch off to something else. And so Solomon does that kind of branching a lot, and if you don't understand that Solomon has already demonstrated that pleasure is not the ultimate end, then you're going to be caught unawares by that, and those are going to kind of throw you off. So a couple things just up front. Ecclesiastes is not saying that pleasure is a bad thing, but Ecclesiastes is saying that pleasure is not the thing that you should live your life for. If you live your life for pleasure, if you pursue all of the things that you think you want, the only thing that lands you is sitting at the end of your life regretting all of the things that you will no longer be able to enjoy when you actually face death. Just like Solomon did. Pleasure is not going to be the answer for how to live life under the sun. And Solomon demonstrates that first by walking you through his own experience. And next week, we're going to go through the second half of Solomon walking you through his own experience. But for now, I think I've waxed eloquent long enough. Sorry for the length on this one. But, oh man, it really is encouraging. Like, I know that it's kind of a depressing thing to be like, this is all the things that make your life suck, but these are all the things that you think you want, and they're going to leave you regretful. But again, we have a strong tendency within ourselves to pursue these things, and Solomon is just telling us, hey, I did that. Let me remind you that it's not worth it. And that's a very helpful reminder. It's an orienting reminder. Because it helps me right now to not make the decisions that look good to me and instead to make the decisions that I know I will ultimately be glad I had made, even if not when I'm sitting at my deathbed, when I stand before God. And so, with that, I hope that's encouraging. And I mean, I'm gonna get back to like praying at the end of my messages. So, I'm going to bow my head. You can bow your head. Probably not if you're driving. Probably a bad idea if you're driving. But I'm going to bow my head. I'm going to pray for you guys. Lord, thank you for Ecclesiastes. Thank you for the fact that you know our hearts so well, that you know the things that are so very attractive to us, that you know that we are tempted to want riches and pleasure and accomplishment and a good job as those things that we think are going to ultimately satisfy us. And that, Lord, you've given us the book of Ecclesiastes where Solomon tenderly, lovingly, carefully walks us through that and reminds us that it's not ultimately satisfying. To orient us to the end of our life and to the things that we are going to ultimately wish we had done when we are sitting in the very place that Solomon was sitting when he wrote this book. I pray that you would help us to internalize the lessons of Ecclesiastes and to be encouraged by the lessons of Ecclesiastes. That this would be a sweet, winsome thing, not just for me, but also for the people listening and for anyone who reads this book. Lord, help us to be genuinely helped by the words of wisdom that Solomon offers us, especially to young people, but also to everyone in the middle. Lord, help us to accept these words and to be grateful for them and to also just enjoy the artistry with which Solomon delivers them. And Lord, I pray these things in the name of our King Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you for listening to this episode of Shaking Scripture's Leaves. If you have any questions or if you want to discuss anything from this podcast, you can email me at johnhorning@gmail.com. And you can go to the Shaking Scriptures Leaves website at johnhorning.org, which not only has my other podcast episodes, but also has some blog posts on other issues. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.